You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the rise of free-range parenting. Our guest says lower-income families are held to a different standard when it comes to parenting choices. First, Ford recently announced that it's going to phase out production of some of its most well-known cars. After years of declining car sales, the Ford company plans to do away with the Taurus, the Fusion, and the Fiesta. It's also going to eliminate the C-Max van. However, Ford said it's going to keep making Mustangs and roll out a new Focus crossover next year. The changes allow Ford to put more of its resources into trucks and SUVs, which have grown in popularity. In addition, Ford plans to bring 16 electric vehicles to the market over the next handful of years. So what do these changes mean for the future of Ford and the rest of the auto industry and for consumers? Jamie Page Deaton is the managing automotive editor at U.S. News and World Report. She's also a North American Car and Truck of the Year juror. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, symbolic value-wise, Ford is the company that started putting cars in everyone's driveways before they even had driveways, probably. How big a deal is it to see Ford really separating itself so much from the car market right now?
Well, really, it depends on who you ask. I think if you're really into automotive history, to see Ford leave the car market is a little bit bittersweet. But for consumers, honestly, I don't think a lot of them are going to notice. And that's because consumers aren't buying Ford cars, which is why they've decided to move away from that segment of the market. If you just look at auto sales in general, sales of crossovers and light-duty SUVs and trucks are really outpacing car sales. And car sales across all brands have been declining for many years now, and they really just haven't found the bottom yet. So it's, financially speaking, in the short term, this is a really smart move by Ford.
What's up with us car shoppers that we're not buying cars? We're getting trucks and SUVs more and more.
Well, really, you know, there's a couple of factors there. One is gas is cheap. There's really no penalty now for buying an SUV. People aren't feeling it in their wallets. Beyond gas being less expensive than it has been in the past, SUVs are really getting better fuel economy than they used to. In fact, a lot of Ford SUVs actually match the fuel economy of some of the cars that they're killing. So, for example, if you get a 2018 Ford Taurus with all-wheel drive, it gets a combined 19 miles to the gallon. Well, that's the same fuel economy as a Ford Edge all-wheel drive SUV. And then if you get, you know, a Ford EcoSport all-wheel drive, which is one of their newer small crossovers, it gets 25 miles to the gallon combined, whereas the Ford Fusion all-wheel drive gets 23 miles to the gallon combined. So consumers have really moved into SUVs as there's been, you know, less of a fuel economy penalty for them to pay. Beyond that, too, consumers really like crossovers, SUVs, and trucks because of the higher seating position. I think there's a conception there that, you know, you've got better visibility, you feel a little bit safer. And also today's SUVs and crossovers are just much more comfortable and much more practical than they used to be.
You mentioned this is across the industry, this trend away from cars. Was Ford feeling that maybe more than other manufacturers?
Yeah, if you look at the decline in the sales of these Ford cars, I mean, some of them were down, you know, in the double digits year over year. Whereas if you compare that to sales of, say, the Honda Accord, now the Honda Accord year over year has seen sales decline of about 6%, which is bad, but not nearly as bad as some of, you know, the 22% sales decline that Ford has seen.
How does this all affect the corporate average fuel economy standards, which may be up for a change that's fleet-wide? Is this going to make it harder, easier, neither for Ford to keep up with standards?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. Ford is saying that this should be no big deal for them because, as they point out, a lot of their crossovers and SUVs get similar fuel economy to some of the cars that they're killing. Beyond that, too, Ford is going to take a lot of the money that they've been losing on these cars and invest it in hybrids and electric vehicles. So if they continue on that path, it shouldn't be that hard for them to meet these standards, which industry-wide, you know, they're a little bit ahead of some of the targets that were set by the Obama administration. Now, if, you know, the Trump administration, if they back off on these standards and consumers continue to just move, you know, vote with their wallets and move towards trucks and SUVs, then it might be a little bit harder because in those cases, Ford will just be responding to the market. You know, they won't have to invest the money in developing more efficient vehicles. And frankly, they will be delivering vehicles that consumers are asking for, but will be end up being a little bit less efficient. And then, too, if the law changes, they don't have to meet the same standards, you know, and the market's not demanding that they meet the same standards. Well, why would they? So we might see them shift a little bit depending on what happens, you know, with the current administration and really what consumers do.
Do we have a little bit of amnesia here because gas prices did get up, you know, to $4 a gallon in a lot of places? Theoretically, that could happen again, right?
Oh, absolutely. So this is why, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, in the short term,
you did use the phrase
really
in the short term, yeah,
by Ford. Because they, you know, they saw their stock move up. They're taking their resources out of less profitable products and putting them into more profitable products. But if there were something that caused gas prices to spike, Ford would be left with no, you know, fuel-efficient products unless they really invest robustly in their, you know, electric vehicles and in their hybrid vehicles. So Ford could really be caught flat-footed if things change, you know, within the oil market. At this point, though, you know, they're doubling down on their SUVs and not expecting, you know, gas prices to go up. So we'll just have to kind of keep an eye on it and see what happens.
Talking to Jamie Page Deaton, managing automotive editor at U.S. News and World Report, about the news from Ford that they're mostly getting out of the car market, focusing on trucks, SUVs, and maybe the electric cars of the future. Jamie, let's look at the models that are going away. Probably the best known one, I guess, is the Taurus. Was it a bad car? Was there a reason it was not selling as well as it used to?
Absolutely not. The Taurus is a great car. The reason it's not selling well is really just consumers want crossovers and SUVs. You know, we're seeing decline across all brands with cars. And, you know, if you look at a lot of these, too, you know, if you're in the market for a car, you know, any of these discontinued Ford models would be excellent choices, particularly if you look at the smaller models like the Ford Focus and the Ford Fiesta. They have some high-performance variants that are just wicked good fun to drive. And now we're seeing discounts now, you know, of up to $5,000. And these are cars that you used to never be able to get a discount on. But really, you're going to see some of the best deals on cars like the Taurus and cars like the Fusion that don't have that kind of enthusiast following. So, you know, if you're a consumer and you're looking for a car and you don't really care about driving an SUV or a crossover, this is a great opportunity for you to pick up some very good models at deeply discounted prices.
I don't know if you can predict the timing. If somebody's in the market, should they be shopping this weekend? Should they wait until the line peters out, I don't know, through the rest of this year and early next year? Well, how do you time this the best?
Well, I mean, the closer you get to the end of the line, the better the deals are going to be, is what we're anticipating. Now, that could, of course, change if all of a sudden, you know, there's a, you know, uproar in the oil market or something like that. But, you know, already, like I said, we're seeing some discounts on some of the smaller models. Already, dealers were offering a lot of discounts on these cars because the sales were so slow. The Taurus is slated to end next spring, and so you might be able to get your best deals then. Some of these other cars, they haven't announced the timeline for doing away with them. So if you really like, for example, you know, the Fusion, which is a great car and, you know, one of the few mid-size sedans that you can actually get with all-wheel drive, you know, that's one where I would just kind of keep an eye out and start tracking prices. You can go to cars.usnews.com, and we have pricing tools where we track real-time prices and real-time transaction prices, so what people are actually paying for cars in your zip code. So that is a great tool so you can kind of track it and see what's going on. We also offer buying insights where we track sales numbers. We track what automakers are spending on incentives, and, you know, we track transaction prices. So we have our team of analysts saying, all right, if you want this car, buy now. So you can track that a little bit over time. But generally, the closer you get to the demise of a car, the lower price you're going to pay.
I want to talk about brand loyalty a little bit. I grew up not too far from Detroit, and, you know, we'd see the stickers, rather push a Ford than drive a Chevy, and Chevy enthusiasts had their own things. Those two brands really had a dueling fan base. If there's a Ford fan who wants this kind of car, what are they going to do? Are they going to be loyal still to Ford and try to find a way to stay with Ford, or does it not work that way anymore?
You know, where we really see the brand loyalty is in the truck markets and in the kind of the enthusiast market. So if you've driven, you know, an F-150 your entire life, you would definitely not be switching over to Chevy, and you won't need to because the F-150 is so profitable for Ford. But the cars that they're looking at, you know, getting rid of, the Fusion, the Taurus, and the Focus, and the Fiesta, with the exception of the high-performance models, of the Fiesta and the Fusion, there's really not going to be a lot of brand loyalty there. You know, maybe there's some people who, you know, will go from, you know, driving a Taurus to driving an Edge or something like that. But I think a lot of those buyers are going to be totally fine going over from a Taurus into a Chevy Impala, which is another good car, or a Toyota Avalon even.
Once upon a time, I think if you said the word car in America, people would picture the black Model T by Ford. Now, I think if you say pickup truck in America, the image that pops into people's heads is going to be the F-150. How did Ford get so dominant in the pickup truck models these days?
Well, I mean, they just chipped away at it. And, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is Ford was introducing trucks alongside the Model T as well. They had truck versions. And so they were really kind of the company that invented the pickup truck. And they've just chipped at it and chipped away at it, you know, for well over 100 years now. And so they've become incredibly dominant. You know, the F-150 is, you know, not only the best-selling truck in America, it is the best-selling vehicle in America. And really it comes down to they offer consumers what they want with the F-150. You can get an F-150, you know, you can get it kitted out as a basic work truck, and you can get it kitted out as a King Ranch super luxury truck and really everything in between. You know, the F-150, if you get the big four-door model, it makes a good family hauler that you can throw your toys in on the weekend. And you can also get it with some really high-tech tools. You know, they have systems that'll track, you know, using RFID tags, they'll track, you know, your tools to make sure you didn't leave them at a job site. You can print bills and invoices from inside the truck. So really by staying at the forefront of what consumers are looking for with trucks and also offering all the capability, and at the same time, you know, Ford has really done a good job making their trucks very fuel efficient. So again, consumers don't pay a penalty at the pump for driving a truck, or at least they don't pay as big a one as they used to. That's really kept them on top when it comes to sales. But as you mentioned before, you know, there are some brand loyalists. I'm sure there's some listeners now, you know, driving along in their Chevy or driving along in their Ram who think that I'm full of it. But if you just look
they've
at what Ford's done over the years.
Yeah. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jamie Page Deaton is the managing automotive editor at U.S. News and World Report. We talked with her about Ford's decision to kill three of its main passenger cars. Free-range parenting has been on the rise in the past decade, and Utah recently became the first state to explicitly legalize free-range parenting, which loosens previous laws around things like letting kids walk to school or play outside unsupervised and stay at home alone. But our next guest says poor and working-class parents will find themselves held to a different set of standards in the public eye, as well as with authorities and institutions when it comes to free-range parenting. Jessica McRoy-Colarco is an assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University. She's the author of Negotiating Opportunities, How the Middle Class Secures Advantages in School. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, big picture, first of all, it seems like there's a pendulum swing between we got to keep close eye on our kids to keep them safe all the time and ideas that look more like free-range parenting, let them out on their own more. Can you talk about how that swings back and forth?
Sure. I would say that popular attitudes about parenting do seem to swing back and forth every few generations. But I think the key thing to keep in mind here is that we think of free-range parenting as this relatively new movement, but it's something that some parents have been doing, not necessarily out of choice, but in many cases out of necessity for a very long time and in very many cases. So parents who have to work long hours, parents who don't have the resources to afford childcare, especially after school childcare, childcare when they have to work but their children are sick or during the summertime. So those parents have often practiced what we might call free-range parenting without the protections, without the legal protections that some new laws are providing, but it often goes under the radar. It's not something that we pay a lot of attention to, and it certainly hasn't gotten the attention that the kind of free-range parenting that we hear a lot about in the media today has gotten.
And that's a big point you write about, is that when we talk about helicopter parenting or free-range parenting, a lot of that seems to have to do with middle-class parents and on up the economic scale. Things look different for people at lower incomes.
Absolutely. So the parents at the top of the income spectrum, the parents who have privilege, whether it's race or class privilege, kind of have the freedom to avoid penalties in many cases. I mean, certainly we have heard of high-profile cases where parents get in trouble, especially for engaging in free-range parenting, but usually they don't face severe consequences, at least, whereas parents who don't have that kind of privilege, who don't have race or class privilege to protect them in those cases, they're the ones who really suffer the consequences when they, oftentimes out of necessity, allow their kids to stay home alone or to walk to friends' houses or to walk to school or leave them in cars by themselves. Those are the parents that often don't have the protections to keep them out of trouble.
Right. It seems to happen that what might be considered free-range parenting for, say, a middle-class parent might be looked at as neglect for that lower-income parent. Why does it work out that way?
Sure. And there's been some research to suggest that people perceive parenting differently depending on sort of the motives that they perceive behind what parents are doing. If they think that parents are doing this out of a sort of moral choice to give their kids independence, it's perceived very differently than if a parent has to do this, or if the parent doesn't have resources at home, if the kid doesn't have enough food at home, or if the parent is struggling to make ends meet, if the neighborhood isn't a good neighborhood, if the mother's choices or parent's choices in other areas are seen as potentially suspect. We know that from implicit bias research that people are perceived differently on the basis of race and class, and that oftentimes people of color, parents of color, and parents from lower income families are often judged more harshly.
Is there a geographic element here? If the middle class parent can afford to live in a quiet street without a lot of traffic, it's one thing to let their kids run out and play. If you are in a less safe neighborhood with, you know, three lanes of traffic each way on the streets, letting that kid walk outside might be less safe.
I think that's certainly one way to think about it, in that geography does matter in these considerations, but I would question sort of the idea of, should that be the only factor, and should it only be parents who can afford to live in high-income neighborhoods that are protected by gated communities or that have parks on every corner where it's 100% safe to walk down the street? Should those be the only parents and the only kids who are afforded the independence that goes along with free-range parenting?
And let's look at the scrutiny that lower income or maybe ethnic minority parent might get that someone else might not. How does it play out on a day-to-day level? Who is looking at the decisions these parents are making or forced to make in some cases, making that call like, hey, there needs to be some kind of legal intervention here?
Sure. We know that the number of CPS calls or Child Protective Services calls, it disproportionately affects low-income families, and especially low-income families of color, in the sense that they are overwhelmingly the ones who are dealing with child welfare agencies, child protective services, and even in cases where those calls are found to be without merit, that can still create significant amounts of stress for families and for their children. If they're dealing with a constant fear of having their children taken away just because they might have to leave them home because they have to choose between, do I go to work today and leave my child at home when they're sick, or do I stay home and potentially risk losing my job because my job doesn't offer protections like staying home when my kid is sick? And so I think that it creates an impossible set of choices, especially for families of limited means and families that are worried about how society perceives them already.
And let's talk about the ability and the resources to advocate as a parent. So suppose that low-income parent and the middle-class parent across town, they get the same report. They get the same call that brings in or that reports them to a school administrator, Child Protective Services, whatever. How does that play out differently given their different resources?
Sure. One of the things that I find in my own research is that middle-class parents, especially middle and upper-middle-class parents, are particularly good at talking themselves out of trouble and their kids out of trouble, in the sense that they're very comfortable pushing back, threatening to get lawyers involved. They have the networks and the resources and the knowledge to know how to push back against the system, whereas lower-income parents, families of color, are much more afraid of the system in many cases. They understand the power of authority and the way that it can affect their daily lives. They don't have the same privilege or the same entitlement to push back when they get in trouble. They oftentimes accept that these are the rules and these are the consequences that goes along with breaking them, where privileged parents often don't accept that. They'll say, why does the rule have to be this way, or why should I be held to this rule when I know what I was doing was right in this case? And so we see that playing out differently in terms of families and their ability to avoid the kind of punishments that go along with these systems of child welfare, as well as punishments in other domains as well.
Talking to Jessica McCrory-Calarco, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Indiana University, about what's called free-range parenting and how it plays out differently if you are lower income, middle income, or beyond. Jessica, what could change this? How could this be equalized so that, as you're saying earlier, parents from all different backgrounds, wherever they might live, have the same opportunity to boost the independence of their kids?
Sure. I mean, certainly we've seen some laws that have tried to be put in place to help protect parents who are trying to give their children more independence. But I would argue that some of those laws have problematic clauses in them that only protect parents whose children's basic needs are met and only whose children are sufficiently old enough or seen as sufficiently mature. And that leaves too much wiggle room. And so what I would say is that we really need, if we're going to pass laws to protect things like free-range parenting, that we need to have those laws protect all families equally, regardless of their race and resources. And on a more basic level, we need policy that give all families the resources to meet their basic needs, so that parents aren't having to leave their children home out of necessity when they're too young or in neighborhoods that aren't as safe as the parents would want them to be. So giving parents the choice as opposed to letting free-range parenting be a choice as opposed to a necessity, giving parents the resources that they need, child care, reliable work hours, freedom to not go to work if their children have to stay home sick without fear of losing their jobs. And also programs to educate police officers and case officers, caseworkers and prosecutors and judges about the kinds of implicit biases that exist in our system, especially against poor and working class parents and especially parents of color, to help so that when these cases do show up in the court system or in the legal system, that those parents aren't subjected to the same level of bias that we see today.
And Jessica, as we wrap up, we've heard a lot of argument over the helicopter parenting versus free-range parenting. Not as much about how it plays out differently for people of different economic classes. Do you feel like you're a lone voice here, or are other people, maybe people in the system, starting to pay attention?
I mean, certainly the response that I've gotten to the article that I wrote, there are a lot of parents out there who are thinking about this, and there are some advocates out there, especially in the legal system, child welfare advocates who are thinking about this and dealing with this on a day-to-day basis as well. I got emails and tweets from a number of people who work in the legal system who are defending these families on a day-to-day basis and saying, yes, this is what I experience, this is what I see. These families are treated differently by the court system, they're treated differently by the child welfare system, and people often aren't paying the same attention to those cases as they are to the families who, it's very easy to pay media attention to a family. A wealthy family living in the suburbs who gets called into question because they let their kids walk to school alone. But the same media attention and the same it doesn't raise alarm for the public when it happens to families that we sort of see families of color, low income families, and we sort of assume that that's the choices that they're making, and that we sort of assume that it would be okay for them to be called into question by the legal system, whereas we only tend to pay attention to the cases that seem outside of the norm.
We'll leave it there. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Jessica McCrory-Calarco, an assistant professor of sociology at Indiana University. We've been talking about free-range parenting and how parents of color and working-class families are treated compared to middle or upper-class parents. There's been a lot of action this week on the legal issues facing President Trump and the White House. Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's newly appointed attorney, has added information to the Stormy Daniels case that contradicts both the president and his longtime lawyer, Michael Cohen. Plus, some House Republicans have drafted impeachment papers for Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. And meanwhile, there's a lot of talk over whether or not the president should be interviewed by special counsel Robert Mueller. Paul Nolet is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, a lot going on, as I said, Paul, the Russia investigation and this investigation of President Trump's alleged affair with Stormy Daniels. The investigation, not so much about that, but about how the payoff money was handled. A new piece of that story unfolded when President Trump's newly appointed lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, talked with Fox News host Sean Hannity. Here's a listen.
I was talking about the $130,000 payment,
right?
The settlement payment, which is a very regular thing for lawyers to do. The question there was, the only possible violation there would be, was it a campaign finance violation, which usually would result in a fine, by the way, not this big stormtroopers coming in and breaking down his apartment and breaking down his office. That was money that was paid by his lawyer, the way I would do, out of his law firm funds or whatever funds, doesn't matter. The president reimbursed that over a period of several months.
And that's the new bit there, Paul. The president reimbursed that over several months. The president had said he didn't know about that payment when asked earlier. Is this a big revelation?
I think it is, for a couple of reasons. I mean, I think there's really two big things in what Rudy Giuliani said. I think the big one is the fact that it contradicts what Trump had been saying for some time, which is that he knew nothing about these payments whatsoever. And so it really raises some questions about what sort of connection was there, after all, since the president had said one thing and now Giuliani, his lawyer now, is saying another. I think the other interesting part of that is how it was over a period of time, as Giuliani said, where these reimbursements for these payments occurred, because that itself can raise some real questions and potentially even raise get to the level of a crime of illegal structuring if those payments were done in such a way to avoid getting any additional oversight by being over $10,000. So a couple of big revelations there, I think.
And with the campaign finance angle here, a key point is that this was President Trump's apparently personal money reimbursing his lawyer, Michael Cohen, not Trump campaign money, not Trump organization business money. Is that an important distinction?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be as well, because it's a real question here of did these payments, was it a campaign type payment or was it a personal thing? What exactly was it? And so in terms of where the sources of the money are coming from and what the really what the purposes of these payments are really does matter legally to how problematic these payments actually are.
Now, with the whole Stormy Daniels story, I mean, there's a salacious angle. This is a porn actress alleging to have had sex with Donald Trump back in the day. He denies that, by the way. This payout and questions over how it was handled. But, you know, this affair, even if it happened, it's not illegal. Is this something that actually could have legal consequences for President Trump or the people around him?
Well, it could for a number of reasons. Like you mentioned, an affair itself is not illegal. However, there's a number of these other legal, kind of a legal web around Donald Trump that could end up being a real problem for him. You mentioned the campaign finance angle being an issue. Now you actually have Stormy Daniels, whose lawyer is filing a defamation charge against Trump. So you have that. So there's actually a number of these legal issues across campaign finance, defamation, illegal structuring that all could come to the fore here depending on how this proceeds. And I think Rudy Giuliani's comments here really kind of raised the level of potential danger for the president.
Outside of the legal side of things, the credibility angle here, the president had said he wasn't aware of this previously. Sarah Sanders in press conferences had said, hey, this is for the personal attorney. This is Michael Cohen. This is not something we're aware of. And now Rudy Giuliani apparently saying, yeah, the president was aware of these payments. President Trump saying he was aware. And now some parsing going on today. I don't know where this has landed at this point. Does this raise credibility issues here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I mean, President Trump has come under fire in other circumstances, in other contexts, for certainly stretching the truth, if not outright lying, on a number of issues. Everything from, you know, crowd sizes at the inauguration to policy matters and such. And so I think that there had been some, and continues to be, some credibility issues with the administration to begin with. And I think when you start having Trump's own lawyer contradicting what he said and then getting one story after another that's different about what actually happened, I mean, it really raises some questions about, well, what really is the true story here? Because we're getting different versions of what happened.
Talking to Paul Nolette from Marquette University about some of the legal issues facing the Trump administration, President Trump, his campaign, the Mueller probe, Stormy Daniels, and more. A lot going on, trying to untangle some of it. Paul, one of the things going on is more changes in the president's legal team lately. Ty Cobb, his attorney, another one out. Emmett Flood in. Rudy Giuliani joined the team over the last couple weeks. If you're a person anywhere in the world facing potential big legal trouble, is it a problem to be juggling lawyers left and right?
Yeah, and especially since, I mean, Bob Mueller's team, which has been a pretty, stable team of lawyers, is a very good team, too. I mean, they very much know what they're doing. And I think having lawyers coming in and out of the administration working on this is not going to be very helpful. I will say that I think particularly Emmett Flood coming in, he's an experienced attorney, a very good one and well-respected one, who I think has a lot more experience dealing with this sort of thing than, say, Ty Cobb did. But nevertheless, I think coming into an investigation that's already very much, very advanced investigation is going to be tough for any lawyer, no matter what quality.
Is it a problem for the president that his lawyers are often speaking on TV, or at least in one case publicly in a restaurant, saying things that could end up being used against them later?
Yeah, and this is something that typically you would think, you know, lawyers are going to be careful about this sort of thing and not get their clients in any more potential danger. But we haven't seen that so far with Trump's attorneys. And it's the same thing with Trump tweeting, which has also caused some legal issues as well, which is basically at a certain point, I know that you're trying to make the political case for your client, but ultimately, if it hurts the legal case, then that really can backfire, and I think so far it has.
Another story we've been watching today, and the details have changed through the course of the afternoon. Michael Cohen, again, longtime lawyer for President Trump. He'd had this raid. It turns out the FBI apparently is monitoring his phone communications, apparently meaning who he's calling, looking at phone numbers. It had been reported earlier by NBC that his phone had been tapped, implying that, you know, his calls may be being recorded or listened to. That would have been a big deal. Is the monitoring of his phone communications, just who he's talking to, a big deal?
Well, I think it is for a number of reasons. I mean, number one, in terms of what investigators actually find out from that evidence that's being collected, but also just the fact that they're doing this, which is pretty unusual, indicates that they must have had some strong reasons and evidence in order to even get this off the ground, to be able to do these sorts of things, including raid the office in early April, and then these newest kind of pushing the investigation even further with these taps and such. So in order to do that, you need to be able to have some very strong evidence that there's problematic illegal activity going on. And so the fact that investigators and prosecutors, I mean, that they've taken these steps to this point seems to indicate that there's a lot going on behind the scenes, that a lot of which we don't even know about yet.
We're talking to Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at some of the latest in the legal proceedings involving President Trump and the White House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of twists and turns like Rudy Giuliani now representing President Trump, saying that the president did know about the payout to Stormy Daniels? Is this a big story to you, or should we be moving on from that? Should the president sit down for an interview with Robert Mueller? Should he have to, whether he wants to or not? Do you have questions about the ongoing Russia investigations and all the stuff? There's a lot going on. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're talking to Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We're getting an update on the ongoing investigations related to the Trump campaign, the Stormy Daniels settlement, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the ongoing Russia investigation? Should President Trump talk to Robert Mueller and his team? Should he have to, even if he doesn't want to? Call 800-642-1234. And are you following the Stormy Daniels payoff story? What do you think of that? Is this a big deal or kind of a sideshow? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to your calls now. John is on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi, guys. I have a question. I'm curious. I've never heard anybody talk about it. What if Mueller subpoenaed the president, and let's say the president didn't want to answer any questions and he just completely ignored the subpoena? What kind of consequences would follow from that, and would that bring about a constitutional crisis? And I'll just hang up and listen to the answer.
John, thanks for the call. And this, Paul, is a live question. There are reports that the Mueller team had told President Trump's people, hey, if the president doesn't talk to us voluntarily, maybe we subpoena him. So what happens if they subpoena the president? The president says, I'm the president, I don't have to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question by John there. And it is an open question. The Constitution doesn't say anything about that. And in fact, this is something that in all of American history so far, it's an unresolved question. So not only is there nothing in the constitutional writing, but even in constitutional practice and political practice, there's no clear answer here. I will say that the Department of Justice itself has some has basically said, for instance, that the president cannot be indicted on a crime. And they've taken the position, and of course they are part of the executive branch, that the because the president's duties are so profound and essentially the president is so busy with policy that getting involved in the legal matters, kind of day-to-day legal matters, would be very distracting for the president. Now, in terms of actually complying with certain judicial processes, well, we saw that with the Nixon administration, and in that case, the court said, look, the president can't completely ignore the judicial process altogether and say, I'm not going to be a part of this. So it's a delicate balance here, I think, between the position that the DOJ takes, generally, saying, hey, the president shouldn't get bogged down with judicial matters, and needing to comply with the general rule of law. So I think, John suggested that it might raise a constitutional crisis if Trump just says, you know what, you want me involved in this, but I'm not going to comply. I think that would really raise, I don't know if it would quite reach the level of constitutional crisis, would have to see what happens next, but it certainly would get us closer to that point.
Staying with the idea of President Trump sitting down with Mueller's team, we had questions leaked by someone, questions, we don't know who exactly, questions that supposedly the Mueller team wanted to ask the president. In that interview we were talking about with Rudy Giuliani, Giuliani called them questions intended to trap the president. A lot of feelings questions. What does the president think? What does the president feel? Here's a clip of Giuliani now talking about a potential interview.
If they're objective, we can work something out. If they're not, then we have to shake hands and basically go into a litigation over, do they have the power to subpoena? And I think they lost that power. This is a completely tainted investigation.
So maybe they could negotiate terms of a meeting between the Mueller team and the president?
Yeah, and I think that they would, but I do think that one thing that Giuliani is doing here, and perhaps this entire legal or lawyer shakeup in the administration, is really to try to take more of a hardball stance than, say, Ty Cobb did, who was trying to get more of a partnership with the Mueller team. And so I think the strategy going on here is going to try to pressure Mueller to agree to a number of demands that structures how he might talk with the president if it gets to that point. So I think that negotiation is certainly going to be forthcoming.
I want to bring on another caller now. Paul is with us in Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hi. I just want to talk to the professor about a comment he made about taking records from Cohen's office and now going into the phone records. And I've heard this off-the-cuff comment so many times for 17 months that there must be something else going on or they won't be doing it. I think it's time that we drop the faith in a huge part of the FBI and the DOJ and say maybe there is nothing else going on, because for 17 months there has been nothing else going on except an evolution of corruption within the FBI and the DOJ. FISA warrants are obtained with false information. We all think, well, they got FISA warrants. The judge had to look at this. There must be something else going on. And then it turns out, well, the FBI lied about the information of the dossier and where it came from and everything else. And now we're into Cohen, and I hear again, well, there must be something else going on, or they would go after phone records. When are we going to man up on this and just say, this is just a blood fest for somebody that 50% of the country just hates to death?
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And Paul, is not alone, saying, hey, they've been at this a long time, since really before the election. They really haven't found too much rock solid except for indictments of, you know, Michael Flynn and some other people involved with the campaign. Maybe it is time to wrap it up.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, one is to put this investigation in historical perspective. And when we look at other investigations of administrations, including Watergate during the Nixon era, they take a long time to play themselves out. So the fact that we don't know everything that there is to know about what Mueller has been doing as part of this investigation isn't particularly surprising at this point. It's been going on for a while. It seems like it's been a long time, but in historical perspective, it's pretty much online with a number of other investigations that have happened in American history. And the other thing is that, you know, Paul made some comments about, you know, the FBI lied about the dossier and stuff. But, I mean, so, and you've heard this from the administration and from the president that this is a witch hunt. But the problem with this is that when it comes to the investigation, when it comes to what Robert Mueller is doing, there are at least some checks on the system. In other words, I mean, Mueller has to go to Rod Rosenstein in order to justify certain parts of his investigation. There's grand juries involved. There is the FISA court. But there's no check on political attacks on the FBI or the Department of Justice. And so that would be one thing that I would raise as a concern, is that there's certainly a lot of incentive to push back on the investigation on the part of the administration, but they can do so and they can lob critiques of the FBI without any proof. And if they don't bring any proof saying that the FBI is acting politically, then I think ultimately, if there's no proof there, then that ultimately has a sapping effect on the rule of law and the Department of Justice itself.
Talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University about the latest in ongoing Russia investigations, other legal issues facing the president and the White House. Paul, so much going on. What are you watching for next? What shoes are you waiting to drop? Or are we just going to keep on being surprised by the next development?
Well, I think there's been a lot of things that have been surprising throughout this entire thing. And there is still a lot to be known about what Mueller has been doing and what he's been collecting that all of us are kind of in the dark about. And it also kind of depends on what the administration does. I mean, as we were talking about a little bit earlier with Giuliani, we're getting these different stories about what happened in cases like the Stormy Daniels settlement and in the Russia investigation. And until these some more concrete proof about what actually happened comes out, it's going to be hard to gauge on a day-to-day basis what exactly is going to happen next.
And do you expect to see the president in a tweet implied, hey, maybe I may be taking action that I am entitled to as president? Briefly, do you think something big might come from that angle, a firing of Rod Rosenstein, Mueller, something like that?
Well, it seems like some of that rhetoric, including the tweet that you're referencing, has been potentially setting up that possibility. But I think at this point, even many Republicans, I think, certainly Republican policy makers in Congress, would have some real pushback on the administration if he actually did take that step.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He joined us to talk about the latest in Russia investigations and other legal issues facing the White House. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report compares the quality and biodiversity of forests managed by tribal groups with forests managed by other units of government. We'll check out the results. We'll find out how baseball stories can open up lines of communication with people suffering from dementia. Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin is back with us for our weekly roundup of some of the top stories from around Wisconsin. One of the stories probably on our agenda, an EPA ruling on pollution emission restrictions in southeastern Wisconsin. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, wild mushroom season is on the way in many parts of the state. You might be out there looking for them yourself before too long, or foraging around your local farmer's market to buy them from people who have done the work. We're going to talk to the author of a book called The Mushroom Cookbook. We'll find out what to do with all those great fungi, or fungi, never sure. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.